Welcome back, everyone. I am Cass Piancy. I'm joined, as usual, by my partner in crime, Mr. Bennett Tomlin. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you, Cass?
I'm great. We have our first third-time guest appearance, Mr. Rohan Gray, a professor at Willamette University, the research director of the Digital Fiat Currency Institute. And a much longer list. You can go back to our other episodes if you want to hear the multitude of other things that he's responsible for. Professor Gray, I think we've had quite a week here. We were already going to discuss today the idea of unlimited depositors insurance offered from the FDIC. I was going to take the opposite side of this argument. I was going to battle you on this and say, there's no way this is actually a thing that anyone can do. Lo and behold, here we are. All of Silicon Valley Bank's and Signature Bank's depositors have been fully insured. Even if it's billions of dollars, they're all good. Can we talk about that? What the hell happened this past
week? Yeah, look, you know, I've been working on it for months and they just tweeted it out. You know, I don't know what to say. Like, I mean, it's really, really meant there's not much work left for us to do. No, I mean, it is a kind of incredible moment. I think there's a couple of different things. I was talking to my colleague, Nathan Tankus, about this. So many of these economic crises happen in a very kind of large, multi-industry, multi-sectoral way. You know, you're talking about a lot of pain for average people. You're talking about mortgages. You're talking about sort of broad-based economic decline. So often the banking regulatory part of the story, it's still there. It's still an important part, but it often kind of comes limping after the protecting the people and, you know, what went wrong overall, where was this sort of fraud or whatever else was going on. But this is such a kind of surgical problem. You know, it's limited to a number of banks. They've got a very particular kind of depositor base. There was a very particular kind of problem with government assets and the regulatory treatment of long-term bonds. And the response was also surgically targeted. So what we're seeing now is this kind of very short, sharp moment where the ideological and regulatory implications for banking in general, I think, are kind of at the forefront of everyone's mind, and there's no other distractions. There's not a kind of four-month period for the people to get in and out of the conversational flow. By the time people got into it, by the time even the initial narrative started solidifying, it was over. You know, it's happened. And so I think this is a very rare moment where all eyes are on the sort of same very narrow set of banking regulatory questions at the same time.
Can you talk to us a little bit about what a system with unlimited deposit insurance would look like and how that would contrast with our current system, which ostensibly has the $250,000 cap per account?
Yeah, and I mean, I think the first thing is sort of the difference between implicit and explicit guarantees, right? I would say for a long time, we've had basically implicit unlimited deposit insurance. Certainly, you know, you look at the vast majority of bank failures, they get put into receivership, you know, their depositors get sold to another bank. Very rarely do you see our depositors actually lose any money, and certainly with the big banks, the sort of recognition that they're too big to fail, that if one of the top four banks kind of collapsed, that the government would probably want to step in long before you got to the point of distinguishing between uninsured and insured depositors. So I think that's the first thing is we've had this for a long time. We just haven't made it explicit. And there's two things about that. One is obviously the politics of it, the moral hazard of it. When we keep not acknowledging what we're doing, we don't actually work out how to regulate things properly on the upswing when things are going well. And we don't sort of think about the broader systemic implications. So if we are going to guarantee all deposits, then what is the asset, you know, activity that we are actually implicitly saying is allowed to happen that we will backstop in a crisis moment, therefore taking out any kind of market discipline, market risk out of it. And I think the other part is a legal aspect, which is it's one thing to say, oh yeah, I know I'm going to get bailed out. You know, it's another thing to say 9 times out of 10, we get bailed out. But if you're a money manager with fiduciary responsibilities, right, if you're a bank with fiduciary responsibilities, you can't rely on that as an explanation for why you're putting your funds in an unsafe instrument, you know, unless you're Circle and you just lie about it on your website and say, oh, it's all backed by cash, you know, and you just sort of quite conveniently and intentionally elide the difference between insured and uninsured deposits for your customers and your marketing materials. Unless you're doing that, then you have to find something else. And so it's kind of funny. Someone was saying, where's Zoltan Pozsar in this crisis? Because in 2011, you know, when he was first writing about shadow banking, one of the articles that really sort of struck me was one called Can Shadow Banking Be Addressed Without the Balance Sheet of the Sovereign? And his basic point was, you know, this is in part, at least, a safe asset shortage issue. We have a lot of actors that would love to park their money in a safe government account, but because of deposit insurance caps, can't. And so they're going into treasuries, and then treasuries have a limited amount. And, you know, because of that mismatch, there's pressure to create, you know, safe asset-like instruments that give the appearance of being safe. And he identified that as a big driver of sort of shadow banking and shadow money in general. But we're also seeing now that this is also a function of the way that we treated bonds. You know, we had this system where these banks were expected to hold on to high-quality liquid assets, and we could value those bonds at hold-to-maturity prices rather than mark-to-market prices, which was fine as long as you didn't actually need the liquidity, right? As long as you didn't actually need to sell those bonds at any point. And I think what we're seeing now is a recognition that even though they are safe in the credit risk sense, they're not safe in interest rate and duration risk sense, but the central bank is basically saying we don't want that to be a problem anymore. We're going to take that off the balance sheet. We're going to make the whole bond structure part of a safe asset system. And I think that's a kind of pretty transformative moment.
Sorry, and I just want to just jump in here because I assume that everybody is familiar with what we're talking about here, just because it's been such crazy news over the past week. Yeah. But in case anyone doesn't know exactly what we're talking about here, Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, and to a lesser extent, Silvergate, which voluntarily liquidated. So that's a different story. But two other banks failed. These are the first bank failures since 2020. And these bank failures have been backstopped by a joint statement from the FDIC, the Treasury, and the Federal Reserve, essentially committing to securing all of these deposits that were going to be in trouble because of two bank runs. Now, these bank runs occurred because of a mismatch in assets, I think is what has been suggested. We're talking about a rate hike from the Fed to the extent that some of these safe bonds and treasuries that Silicon Valley Bank held were no longer valuable or worthwhile. And then they also, from what I've heard, had some mortgage-backed securities that they had to hold on to for a long time that were essentially worthless because they had to hold them for 10 years. The concern right now, and feel free to hop in here, Rohan, but the concern seems to be that there is a moral hazard now that some of these people are essentially getting promised all of this money. They're getting promised that their billions of dollars is secured and insured. Even though some people, I think the last bank that failed before this was in Kansas, some small state bank, they didn't have the kind of insurance that these people were offered. Perhaps their bank was sold, like you're suggesting. Perhaps the depositors were sold and they were all made whole. But they weren't given the same protections that was offered for these two banks right now. How do you address that moral hazard?
I mean, so first of all, I think you could describe, I saw a colleague, I think it was maybe Morgan Ricks or someone, describe it. Basically, you had three tiers, right? The big banks were always going to get bailed out. The small banks were going to get sort of left to be eaten. And then these regional banks, these sort of mid-sized banks, because Silicon Valley Bank, I think, is sort of $200 billion in total assets. And it was a mid-tier bank, right? 20th largest, which is still pretty large, but nowhere near as large as the top handful. And so I would say that that kind of receivership structure that we had in the past, plus the kind of large-scale bailouts in crisis moments, were a kind of de facto government guarantee, but they worked in different ways, right? You have a kind of ex-post bailout emergency facilities at the Fed on one hand, you have the receivership on the other, and then what we had here was a crash that happened sort of so quickly that the government wanted to get in very early. They wanted to get nip it in the bud before it could spread or for other depositors, because to your earlier point, my understanding is that part of the reason that they were holding a lot of those bonds and mortgage-backed securities to an extent is that they were allowed to treat them for regulatory purposes as high-quality liquid assets. So if you're holding reserves earning, 2% versus bonds earning 4%, why would you put your money in reserves if the regulatory treatment says they're the same? Well, you got to manage liquidity. Okay, well, do we really think we're going to have a run on the bank? Probably not. There you are. That's a sort of simple analysis. Now, it shouldn't have happened, especially when interest rates start going up. You should have known that your bonds are going to go down. But the other question should be asked there is, what the hell are the regulators doing allowing you to treat it that way, right? And so then there's this question about the restrictions and things that come up in 2018 and lobbying that was done by banks and things to weaken those liquidity requirements. But I think the bigger question is, what the hell do we want bonds to be? Do we want long-term treasury bonds to be liquid or not? We've been doing QE, we've been making them kind of as close to liquid money for a while, and then because of quantitative tightening, because the Fed's rolling off its balance sheet, it is trying to get away from that again. And the question to me is always why? What are we gaining from that? It's not like we had any problem raising long-term capital through those bonds, so it's not like, we're kind of worrying that we're not going to be able to sell enough bonds for any reason, not that we even need to.
Well, and I just want to get one of the things you mentioned earlier in terms of adding this unlimited deposit insurance is that it might change the way we think about what assets we want these banks holding and what that looks like. So I imagine part of any unlimited deposit insurance scheme is going to be like an increase in the premiums that these banks have to pay. Or on the other side is changing what counts as these types of assets and what they're allowed to hold and how they're allowed to mark them. So in terms of that side, like how it changes the assets the bank holds, what would this look like? What's one way this could look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, you want to get rid of the distinction between all these different kinds of government guaranteed assets, in my opinion. I don't see any value to making 30-year bonds less liquid. But yes, I think the big question, and to Cass's question, the big way to deal with the moral hazard there is simply to give up on a failed regulatory approach. Leave the liability side. Leave it. It's money. Let's just call it money. Let's just move on and focus on the asset side. Focus almost exclusively on the asset side. And I would say, actually, one of the ways to deal with this is not even through liquidity requirements. It's through a more explicit use of the discount window and collateral scheduling, right? So what we're seeing now was the FDIC insuring things, insuring everything up to 100%, but also the Fed's collateral process being expanded and quite kind of dramatically not lending at a discount, right? Historically, almost all collateral lending is done at some haircut, and this was done at par, right? So suddenly you're in this system where if you create a loan asset, you can pledge it, right? And they're starting with open market eligible instruments. But you could do the same thing for any bank asset, right? Any bank asset that needs liquidity could be pledged at the central bank at par, at its acquisition price. And then that money just gets advanced. So you're taking liquidity restrictions off the table entirely. But in doing so, you're saying, well, we get to look at the assets now. We get to look at all of them. We get to assess them. We get to see the whole balance sheet. We get to keep them with us as collateral. And I think the second order implications of that are quite transformative. Take a moment and think about it, right? You can't hypothecate. You can't securitize. You can't resell in secondary markets, right? Loan to originate to distribute model, dead, right? What you are talking about is a system where every time a bank makes an asset, it gets put in cryostasis at the central bank, and then gets turned into money. And that's the actual secret sauce. That's the actual moment that we should be focusing on. If you do it that way, you don't need liquidity requirements. The assets themselves are liquid, right? You don't need all these other things, all these other secondary kind of ways of trying to regulate the quality of these things, because you're doing it directly. You're literally getting all of the assets available to the Fed to inspect at any point in time. And then the only other thing about that is just whether you're actually, whether you're doing this or not, I think it's important to note that the FDIC, its insurance fund, is backed by the Treasury, right? If it runs out, it gets recapitalized by the Treasury. That is to say, it is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. So, is it a good thing to tax banks? Sure, I don't help banks. Let's tax them more, right? Let's tax them out of existence and nationalize the whole damn thing. It's fine with me. I propose public banks in other contexts, right? But this idea that we have to sort of fund it with an insurance premium, I think it's the wrong model. It's a tax model. It's a subsidy plus a tax. We don't need to think of it as insurance. We don't need to think of it as a fund, right? This is all accounting fictions to give the impression that there's no public guarantees, there's no public risk behind it. Meanwhile, the Fed is lending against all this collateral. You know, I think it's a fiction to keep up this distinction.
So can I ask a question here? Because I think we're talking as though all of this is going to change.
Yeah.
And I think what I'm actually believing right now is kind of the opposite of that, where like at this point, having given Silicon Valley Bank and Signature this, I mean, let's call it what it is, right? Like essentially a bailout.
Yeah, bail in to the insured deposit system, right?
Bail in,
yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Bail in. They provided this for them. And I don't think they're going to change the entire regulatory regime. And I don't think they're going to implement entirely new system of control for these banks. And that's actually like really depressing to me. Like as someone pointed out online to me, dfern_eth, pointed out that this has been something that the FDIC, the Treasury, and the Fed have been doing since the SNL crisis. Like, this is not a new thing. And just to get anyone else up to speed, there was a bank called the Bank of New England in 1990, 1991 that had a run on its bank. It was basically utterly insolvent. And the FDIC came in and said, don't worry about it. The limit at the time was $100,000. They said, forget it. It's fine. All of your deposits are totally backed. right now is a crisis. We're going to change the rules. But when a crisis happens 4 or 5 times in someone's lifetime, is it even a crisis anymore, or is it exactly what you're saying? Do we need to upend the entire system?
What am I continuing to do, right? What have I done again? Come on, you know?
Well, and I think to add to Cass's question here, when we had you on to discuss the Stable Act, one of the things we talked about how was, like, with the Reserve Primary Fund and the money market funds in 2008, when the liquidity started to come out, the federal government had to come in and basically insure these absolutely uninsured assets because the broader risk was too much beyond that. And when we were talking about the Stable Act, the context was that these money transmitters would end up with basically these Fed master accounts and keep all their money there, which is effectively fully guaranteed by the faith and credit of the United States. And it was, I think, a lot of this same argument you're getting at here, which is that we've effectively done this for a long time, but in a structure that doesn't actually support doing this, like, explicitly.
Yeah, it is. My dad has this old line, which I've just started saying more and more. It seems to be the only thing that matters anymore. There's never time to do it right, but there's always time to do it again, right? And so we're just in this, like, Groundhog Day scenario. And so what I'm always trying to work out is, what is changing, right? What is changing the narrative? What is the direction where we cannot do it again? What are we breaking where it literally cannot repeat the same cycle? And I think something has broken this time. And to Cass's earlier point, there's definitely moral hazard, right? There's definitely a bail-in situation. There's definitely a bunch of people that are getting money right now, which, frankly, fuck them. But if that's the price to pay to actually change this system once and for all, fine. You know, it's not like we haven't been bailing people out for decades. It's not like this isn't a large standing problem. Even people like Hyman Minsky were talking about uninsured depositor runs, you know, being the primary source of shadow banking risk. And to your point, Bennett, that we spend so much time trying to maintain these fictitious distinctions between different kinds of money, right? Oh, don't worry, this is backed by 100% collateral in a money market account. Oh, don't worry, this is not government money, this is a claim on money, it's fine. Whereas in practice, people just use this shit as money. They use this shit in very similar ways. The level of, like, information processing that the average consumer with a money market account versus a bank account is doing is not particularly high. They're not going, oh, well, this one's risky and this one isn't, I have to be really careful. They are allowed to be marketed to, right? That these things are safe, right? They're allowed to create all these regulatory things to give the impression that it's safe or safe-ish or safe enough. And then when it all breaks, we go, oh, I can't believe we let it all break. Well, why did we create this ridiculous set of things in the first place? We can look at why there's a deposit insurance cap, you know, oh, the politics of it, blah, blah, blah. It's arbitrary. It's an arbitrary number. And it creates a two-tier depository system that causes this fiction, that causes this delusion, that allows people to keep talking about market discipline in a place where there clearly is none. So I think that this is a moment where the kind of the fiction, the myth, has been completely exposed. And that's what is valuable.
I think your point about market discipline there has been one of the things that's really been sitting with me with Silicon Valley Bank specifically. Many of the people banking there, at least nominally and in the view of our society, are supposed to be intelligent people who have a far higher than average understanding of finance. We could debate how true that perception is, but that's, like, the expectation for the individuals banking there. And, like, apparently, most of these individuals weren't using insured cash sweeps, which, for people who don't know, insured cash sweeps are a service some banks offer where they can effectively give you almost unlimited FDIC insurance by taking the money you deposit and then sweeping it to other FDIC insured accounts at other banks. And so you could access greater than the $250,000 insurance by using products like this. But, like, very few of the companies banking at Silicon Valley Bank were doing that, partially because of the terms of the loans Silicon Valley Bank were giving out. But that's a separate issue, too.
Why do we let them make, like, those loans? You know, like, that's
exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah, like, Silicon Valley was, like, structured to be vulnerable to exactly this, like, across multiple of their decisions, not just, like, the duration risk they took in some of their securities, but, like, across the way they were having their depositors deposit.
Yeah, large hot
but
money.
But I want to pause on that. Sorry. I want to pause on that insured sweep product that almost every major bank offers, because it's exactly what Bennett just said. It is essentially an enormous loophole that allows wealthy people to completely avoid the $250,000 limit that is placed on an individual holder at an individual depositor at a bank.
Well, I think more importantly than just, like, helping wealthy individuals do that, it helps corporations who need to have
small
cash on hand.
Small businesses,
that kind of thing.
Of course. But then, as Bennett said, not only did Silicon Valley Bank like have I think it was 97% of total cash was not insured under the
FDIC rules.
93%, 96%, whatever it was, right? So we had this crazy amount of cash that was not insured, but that it absolutely could have been insured under these rules and regulations that most people who were involved in major business and involved in this stuff understand and know about and utilize. So the fact that all of these venture capitalists were not doing that and were not doing any proper risk management for decades seems to be like, again, we're in a moral hazard minefield here.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how we get away. I guess my point here being, it doesn't seem like they're going to change the rules. It seems like they're going to do the same thing they did in 08 or 91 or whatever, where they said, this was in extraordinary circumstances. Like, we don't intend to ever let this happen again, even though it will. And we're not going to change the rules just because this crisis happened for a little bit. And don't you think the public loses faith if they don't change the rules?
I mean, they should. And, you know, not to be an accelerationist, but I think that's what this is, in a sense. This is heightening the stakes, right? It's heightening this contradiction. And certainly, I think if you look at my colleagues in the banking world, right, people who advise Democrats even more than Republicans, people who'd be considered themselves progressive, although maybe more moderate, you know, probably more moderate than I am or self-identify that way. I think for a lot of them, this is a kind of existential crisis moment, right? They had been committed to the idea of market discipline. They had been committed to this model of private insurance, which, again, can we take a moment and stop and ask, do you think banks feel better about the idea that deposit insurance is framed as a private fund that all the banks get to pay into, that it's on their back? Do you think they actually hate that versus the government provides all the money and we are actually making you a quasi-public entity? Do you think that when they think of the long-term political health of the banking industry's independence from government, that it's the former or the latter narrative that's likely to keep them more insulated? I think it's actually a boon to them that we give this impression that they are funding themselves. I think they actually benefit from the appearance that they are most days of the week self-running, self-governing, and self-funding. I think it's a fiction, and the Fed is the obvious point of that fiction, but I think it allows them to hide behind the idea that most of the time they are mostly in charge. And that is the biggest, in my opinion, political impediment to real change. But to your earlier point, something like 43 or some number like this percent of all deposits in the banking system are uninsured, right? So even though these products exist, like the insured cash sweeps you're just describing, it's not like everybody's using them, right? We still have this two-tier uninsured depository system, which even at just an architectural level, right? I come in with my digital currency hat on, and that's a whole separate conversation we can talk about in a second. But the big concern there is, what if depositors leave? You know, what if there's not enough liquidity and blah, blah, blah? And part of that is because we still have this distinction between deposits and government money. We're not thinking about them in the same category. Why? Well, sure, we insure them, but they're private first. You know, that's the narrative that we are maintaining at the moment. And then to the other question about the insured cash sweeps, I think the big point there is, if we are providing these sort of workarounds, then we are already admitting that we want people to have access to more than the $250,000 cap, right? This is, so all you're saying is that we should have unlimited deposit insurance, but it should be kind of convoluted and hard to understand and easy for people to not kind of have scrutiny. That's what you want? Like, what are you talking about, right? Like, at a certain point, it becomes an excuse in search of a justification, right? Like, they don't want it first. They know they don't want that other thing. And then they're backfilling specific reasons. And it doesn't actually mesh onto reality. But to your point, like, if we don't change these rules, it's a huge problem. And maybe it's just the great level defeatism that I'm coming in with this, although I like to think of myself as someone with doesn't really like to, you know, keep shouting at the wind and raging against the machine, is that at this point, I can't even get my colleagues to agree that unlimited deposit insurance is good, right? You put five financial experts advising them in a room, we'll get four of them saying, no, it's fine, and one of them saying it isn't. Getting to the point where all five are saying this is bad and needs to be changed, it's indefensible, gets us that little bit closer to pressure on the politicians. Because if there's one thing that I've learned doing this work is that politicians actually don't really like writing these kinds of bills, and they need to find some experts willing to validate them.
I spoke with Frances Coppola, and she said, the problem is that banks always have to leverage deposits somehow. If they won't do it by lending, then they'll do it some other way. And I think that presents a good problem, because if that is indeed the case, which I believe her, I think that is right. Like, banks generally are about making money on the deposits that they hold. And if that is true, and we use public funds to build up this insurance fund for depositors, don't you think that the public might get the impression that public dollars are being used to benefit banks?
I mean, first of all, they are. They're being used to benefit banks right now. All the beneficial liquidity access, all of the implicit guarantees that insurance turns your money into money, and not only the explicit guarantees that are of the 250,000 cap, but the implicit guarantees beyond that means that in uninsured depositors, uninsured deposits still have a special place in the liability structure. I would say, you know, maybe I'm misunderstanding what Francis is saying. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I would say that deposits are usually a cost, right? You know, you try to keep it down and all that kind of stuff. It's the reserves or the cash that you get when depositors deposit funds that you might sort of earn interest on if you invested or something. And certainly you can charge fees and fines on having depositors, and having a sort of sticky source of funding means that you're not as susceptible to interest rate, you know, adjustments in the breeze if you're borrowing everything from the money markets and things. But my view on this would be, give all the banks an unlimited overdraft of reserves at 0%. And that sounds like a big handout. But once you do that, you take every rock to hide behind on the field away, right? You take every possible market fiction away, and then it's just left with this idea of, we are giving you government money to extend loans. You are making loan decisions on behalf of the public, and you're taking a cut of that. That's it. That's the only thing you're doing. Very boring, in fact. Underwriting. You're like, yes, man, with Jim Carrey, right? That moment is a very different moment from one where every time there's a financial crisis, every bank is responsible for the payment system, depositors are the hostages in front of them for bailouts, all that kind of thing. You want more loans? We can make more loans. You want more credit? We can create all sorts of credit entities. And hey, you know what else you can do? You can just spend money instead of lending it, right? Putting all of that in the same category and taking the payment system and the deposit system out of it entirely, I don't think it's as much of a subsidy, because we're actually on the cusp of being able to issue a government digital currency that renders the deposit layer obsolete.
So it sounds like you're saying, your suggestion is banks, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it almost sounds like your suggestion is banks shouldn't necessarily be constantly profit seeking. Am I getting that wrong?
Well, banks, I mean, private commercial banks are profit seeking. That's what they do. I'm saying that we should not make them systemically responsible for issuing the core monetary instrument in the payment system. That is an anachronistic thing that doesn't need to happen. If we want banks to be responsible for doing credit allocation and underwriting, which again, you know, reasonable minds can disagree, I suppose, capitalist, socialist, whatever, like, I would spend all of my time on public funding first and then public banking second. And then you kind of go down the list. All the way down here is what I care about, commercial private banking. But at the moment, it's all meshed up with the depository system. Well, one of the biggest things that people are having concerns about at the Bank of International Settlements around and central banks around the world when they're talking about a central bank digital currency is not that it will fail, but that it will work too well and everyone will take their money out of the banking system. And so you're hearing all these, in my opinion, absolutely ridiculous suggestions like, well, we'll just pay no interest on it, or we will just cap the amount that people can hold, or we'll make it really hard to take funds out so that people keep most of their funds in the deposit system. And you're going, wait a second, so you're building this whole digital currency and then you're going to design it to be as undisruptive as possible to limit its actual applications? Because why? You're concerned that deposits will flow out of the banking system? Yes, it's going to make lending so much more expensive. It's going to cause a liquidity crunch. Well, I've got a liquidity cannon here that I can lend at zero interest. So stop doing this. Can we get back to a real conversation about how to build a good digital currency system? And one point last on that is that if you look at the current debate right now around kind of serious stablecoin regulation, what the Treasury and others are talking about, which, you know, who knows if anything's going to come out by the end of this administration. But one of the things that they are talking now, one of the big things they're talking about is tokenized deposits, right? What can banks use this new technology for? Well, screw stablecoin, screw crypto, but some sort of common platform where the deposits can essentially freely transfer between all the different banks in an enclosed environment. That sounds good, they're saying. Well, what I'm hearing is we are finally killing one little block, which is the fiction that each individual bank's deposits are different, right? We are getting closer to one common depository product. And it's only a few steps from there to the government digital currency that I'm talking about, but they're all in the same direction, right? They're all acknowledging that this idea that a deposit is an individualized liability of an individual bank is not actually the way to think about the monetary system.
One thing that I've been ruminating about, like in terms of the Federal Reserve, these bank failures and insuring these deposits is like, and I know you have somewhat heterodox views on monetary theory, and so you may object to the framing here, but like part of the reason the banks ended up in this situation is because the Federal Reserve had been raising rates to try to reduce inflation, causing this duration mismatch that these banks had failed to adequately hedge.
Yep.
Does insuring all these deposits and effectively guaranteeing at the very least, even if these banks fail, the depositors will be safe, allow the Federal Reserve to be more aggressive in their rate movements by reducing the potential impact on the banking system?
Yeah, I mean, so if you do have fully insured deposits, then you certainly have less need for liquidity coverage ratios and all that kind of stuff, right? Your liquidity concerns go down, but the way that you actually do that is not on the liability side, right? It's not on the FDIC insurance side, unless you want to be constantly dealing with kind of that scenario. What you do is you allow the banks to pledge the assets for liquidity and you change the collateral pricing for them, right? And so the real question there is, if the Fed is going to raise rates, is it going to do so in a way that punishes existing bondholders, right? Are we going to have a punishment for being holding an off the run 30-year treasury bond that's been around for 10 years versus buying a brand new 20-year bond because the rates are higher now than they were when the 30-year was issued? Or are you essentially adjusting that rate as we go along, right? Are we essentially creating something that is, even though they have individual maturities, they're really more like a class of consoles where we're just constantly updating the rate, moving it around, right? For all of them. We're just moving the yield curve around on all of the government liabilities. Now, the question then gets begged, what the hell is a 30-year bond, right? My colleague Nathan said, hey, if you can pledge a 30-year bond at the discount window with no haircut, what's its maturity, 30 years or 1 hour, right? And I think that's actually a very fundamental question. I wrote a paper that hasn't been published, but I was pretty proud of it. The Orthodox Economist looked at it in the review process, wasn't. But it was called The Inherent Presentism of Monetary Policy, right? And my point with that is that we have all these words like 30-year bond, 10-year bond stuff, but for 98% of how we actually use them and how we treat them regulatorily speaking, they're just different categories in the present. You can change the 10-year bond rate today. You can change the 5-year bond rate today. Tomorrow, you could switch them around. And it wouldn't change anything about 10 years from the future. It would just change that rate every day, right? Every day, we have a yield curve, and that matters for the relative distribution of interest and all that stuff for these different assets. But over time, what we are saying today about what's going to happen in 30 years has nothing to do with what's actually going to happen in 30 years. It's our conception, the present, of the future. It is not actually the future. And so we can change that. We can move that around. We can invert the yield curve even and then invert it back again, right? So what I think is interesting is if you are moving towards something where you are guaranteeing all the depositors step one, that means you have to focus on the assets step two. And part of that means when you do let them hold some sort of safe asset that you are not letting them incur duration and maturity risk, you know, interest rate risk as well. That is a fundamentally different structure than we have now. We can put certain regulatory scrutiny to bed and focus on other things. And I think that's the sweet sauce that comes out of this, is that we stop having useless conversations and start having much more productive ones.
I'm quite interested in this discussion because I think what you're suggesting is totally upending the entire banking structure, the system at large. Like, you're talking about changing bonds, you're talking about changing insurance, you're talking about changing the way banks interact with one another, how they interact with the Fed, how they interact with the Treasury. You're talking about changing everything. Now, that's part of why I don't suspect they're going to pursue this method of deconstruction and construction. But I want to compare this to the kind of vitriolic debate going on around venture capital right now, because obviously Silicon Valley Bank has the name Silicon Valley in it. Yeah. I think that has
the
been
optics
mentioned
great.
As part of the optics were great. But also they generally are the bank of choice for venture capital. Like, these sophisticated investors were going to Silicon Valley Bank to get their loans, to get their capital, to do things. This is the bank of choice for them. So when Silicon Valley started to fail and collapse, the general public was like, eat shit, libertarian assholes. We don't give a fuck. Fail, lose all your money. We don't care.
Yeah.
But the concern became, right, that this is, especially because you have people like Jason Calacanis, David Sachs, Chamath, the All In podcast, and a bunch of these other venture, public-facing venture capitalists causing bank runs, causing actual bank runs, like inciting this stuff and Peter saying, Thiel. You guys, go to your bank, run to your bank and get your deposits out right now, which definitely doesn't help at all. And for what it's worth, I think all of them should get subpoenaed and get in trouble. They won't. Yeah. But regardless, so we have this, it looks like venture capital has been operating not well for a few decades now, that they've been taking advantage of loopholes, that they've been not doing proper risk management. And the response from the public was, fuck off, we hate you. The response from the governmental agencies was more along the lines of, oh, well, this looks bad, but we're going to save you because this is a systemic risk. What I'm not hearing is how we're going to change venture capital, how the rules and regulations around venture capital are going to be altered to ensure that this doesn't happen again. But in the meantime, this banking structure also seems to be this massive issue. And now people are just saying, it's the government's fault. We need to, you know, the FDIC sucks. It's horrible, even though the FDIC didn't fail at all right now. Like, I'm confused why everyone hates the FDIC suddenly. But like, okay, so here we are, right? But I don't know. It kind of is disheartening to me. Because I'm usually I'm a cynic in some sense, but I'm quite optimistic about the future of humanity. Yeah. And I think that moments like this make me reflect and go like, do these systems and structures just seem so monolithic that we're never even actually going to try to alter it? Or are too many people just incentivized to keep it going the way that it's going right now?
I think we really also need to accentuate that Elizabeth Warren asking questions about Silvergate Bank is clearly what killed Silicon Valley Bank. Don't forget that, Cass.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, you know, we should be trying to not let this crisis go to waste, right? We need to keep the narrative up. We need to keep the narrative focused where it really matters. And I've got no love for any of those people, as I'm sure you can tell, as I'm sure you've guessed. It's not like, the, you know, but I, you know, walk through the crowd. You deserve to take a few eggs for doing the uncomfortable work of trying to fix the structural problem at this point, even if it means bailing these people out in the short term. I'd be quite happy with an investigation. I'd be quite happy with making them, you know, accountable. My big view on that is ultimately the way to render these people powerless is to make them obsolete, right? The way that they are benefiting here is through that complexity, is through those loopholes, is through a system that puts a different set of rules for them than it does for you and I in a bank, right? It is through the idea that they can bank at a bank that is allowed to invest in 30-year bonds and call it liquid, right? That is actually the complexity of the system that benefits those actors every day. And so simplifying it down, even if they get a little windfall on the way up, in the long run makes them so much less powerful, right? Just like saying, hey, if we have unlimited deposit insurance and a collateral schedule where any bank can pledge any loan that they make for no discount, you're going, well, that's a massive subsidy. Yeah, for 5 minutes, right? For 5 minutes. Watch what actually happens to the public's understanding of what that system is on the other side of making it that clear. And if it was such a subsidy, I wouldn't be getting the vociferous opposition from the banks when I suggest it. Now, to your question about how, you know, you deal with big change and whether actually any of it's coming, part of this is you push the Overton window stuff, right? You push the big thing, you get some sort of little change along the way. But part of it is also sometimes change. There's a lot of things that happen very slowly and then all at once. And part of the vantage point of someone like me is I am looking at public banking, I am looking at crypto, I am looking at government digital currencies, I'm looking at banking regulation, I'm looking at the collateral schedule and the Fed liquidity provisioning process as well as the FDIC insurance. So when I'm thinking about these different things, they're already moving. There's already stuff happening. There is already a debate about central bank digital currency and deposit outflow. There is already a debate about public banking. There is already a debate about stable coins and whether they're safe and all that kind of stuff, right? Saying, hey, there should be one thing that we just call money in an account and it should be fully guaranteed and that guarantee should be explicit that you're issuing public dollars, that screws Circle pretty aggressively, right? This is a relitigation of the Stable Act, amongst other things, in the middle of all of this, because Circle lost its peg, right? Circle was suddenly exposed to the uninsured deposits of the bank after claiming it's all the same, blah, blah, blah. Well, if you've got the point where they're literally just holding 100% government-insured deposits and that's the only thing that they can realistically hold, then what are they? They're just an intermediary for the government again, right? They're just a better payments interface. Then they actually can be looked at that way rather than, oh, we're taking on private actors. We get to invest and make money off the float or whatever else it is, right? So I do think, you know, you want to keep your eye on the ball. You don't want to let these guys get away with anything. But in the grand scheme of things, the big win for me is the structural change that renders these actors less powerful, less able to use complexity to obfuscate the grift.
Personally, I just want the guys at the All In podcast to lose their money. Systemically, I realize it's a bad thing, but just like, look at them.
So here's a good example, right? When we talk about the FDIC insurance fund, how are we talking about assessments on banks? It's all this, it is a sort of sub-variant of the taxpayer money trope. That all the money comes from the private sector, right? That we can bail it out as, if we put the money in, then we can take the money back out again. All, everyone's happy. Versus, hey, there's a thing called the infinity sign, and that's where we actually are funding all this from. And we are going to tax some assholes because we don't want them to get a boon out of it. Fine. But if you just say we're always going to fund it 100% and then there's a tax, I can write that in two sentences. I don't need some convoluted fund and all these different premiums and assessments and all that kind of stuff. And so even the very act of having the FDIC fund is reinforcing a narrative about how the economy works that people like Silicon Valley end up winning with. Oh, we're the taxpayers that fund the economy, right? The money comes from somewhere. It comes from us. We're the value creators. That narrative is actually lurking in the background of this whole conversation as well. And I think you render them obsolete by being able to say we could tax 100% of your wealth. 100%. Right? The old Laffer curve, which is bullshit economics, but is political gold, right? There's some optimal tax rate between 0 and 100%. If you tax 0, you get no revenue. If you tax 100%, you get no revenue, right? Somewhere between those is the Goldilocks number that maximizes the amount of revenue. So if you want to fund welfare programs, you need to find that beautiful number. Now, Reagan comes along with Art Laffer and says, we thought it was 40, it's probably closer to 25, right? There is no magic number to maximize revenue. We don't need revenue. We need people to be less rich. We need less money in people's pockets. I want 100% tax. Well, then no one will become a billionaire. Good. Good. Correct. So, correct answer.
I'm gonna pause you here because even though, and I think a lot of people probably know my views on billionaires, which is that pretty much none of them need to exist. We don't need billionaires. They're not a class that needs to exist. Yeah, I agree with you on that. But that doesn't really matter that I agree with you on that because most of our listenership, I will say, is one, very pro-cryptocurrency, I believe, even though we are skeptical, and two, quite libertarian in a lot of senses. Yeah. So they're going to hear your argument, and there's two things that are going to come up for them. One, the state shouldn't be involved in this stuff. That's absurd. Why should the state be involved, even though they're already involved, definitely, but okay. They're going to want to remove the state in full from this stuff. They're going to want to deregulate as opposed to regulate more. And then two, the infinity number that you brought up, I think that is another minefield because we're talking about, even though you're right, and I don't disagree with you, it's almost like when you acknowledge it, you start encountering some issues, it seems like. When you start acknowledging like, yeah, we can just fucking print money, guys. We can literally just print as much money as we want. Well, no, you can't, right? No, you can't just print as much money as you want because at some point, if people start to lose faith in your money printing, the value of the money goes down significantly. Do you think we're flirting with any of that right now?
No, not really. I mean, so on the first point, I think you can't really get out of the government being involved when you're talking about the US dollar, right? You're talking about something denominated in the government's currency. If someone wants to deal with gold, they can try. And then when there's a contractual dispute, I'll take you to court and the court will make you pay in dollars. So you live in a dollar denominated world, first of all. Second of all, I can have debates with high school libertarian philosophies if you want, but really you get to this point where property rights themselves are a public enforceable thing, right? Oh, I just want the government to stay away from me. Yeah, you and what? You and the plot of land that's like half of Montana that you want to have the cops protect? Like this idea of libertarian philosophy that doesn't acknowledge the huge sort of logical hole around property rights, I think is just a non-starter, and it's why libertarians only get 3% of the vote every year, because they want to pretend like they hate the government, but they're the biggest status out there. They just want the government to protect all their property and then let them do whatever they want with it. We have a version of the state for that. It was the white supremacists that ran the South until we beat them in a war, right? The price of living in a society and having private property is that you are subject to taxation and regulation and you work in a monetary system. To your second point about the infinity sign, I mean, again, the statement we can print as much as we want is correct. the question of how much we want is the interesting question, right? Do you want to deal with 10% inflation if it means you have 25% nominal growth? Maybe. Maybe not, right? You can have reasonable minds can disagree about that. You can print as much money as you want. The question is, do you want to print that much? Now, is there some mechanical relationship between printing money and inflation? Not necessarily at all, right? Spending money maybe, but we're just talking about banks making credit. Every day banks are printing money and nobody's saying anything. So if you have a problem with money printing, you should have a problem with everything from commercial banks to money market funds to crypto that are essentially printing demand. Because just because I can make a coin that's got some value or that somebody thinks has some value doesn't mean I'm doing anything to the supply of eggs. So if I make a coin that has some value and then people use that to buy eggs, that's pushing up the price of eggs, just like issuing new government dollars is pushing up the price of eggs. You can make a rationale why that's okay. You can say, oh, there's value added in other ways or whatever. But when it comes to actual prices, when you're looking at not inflation as some concept relating to the quantity of money, but actually to the prices in the economy, which is how we use the term inflation today, right? We haven't used inflation to refer to the quantity of money since the 19th century. Then it isn't to do with how much money is in existence. It's to do with what money is being used to do what and what is going on in those industries and the pricing power, et cetera, et cetera. And so if you want to be dealing with that seriously, yes, we should deal with that. And there are limits on how you can use the money canon if you want to maintain stable prices. But we aren't having that conversation. We're having ridiculously misleading conversations about whether the quantity of money is too high or not, when the thing that we are defining as money is so narrow, it's not even working on its own terms. We're not even looking at all the sources of demand in the economy. So I think, you know, whether people like the infinity sign or not, it's there. It was there in 2020, it was there in 2008, it's been there since 1935, it's been there since 1971, it's been there since 1863, right? We've been doing the infinity sign in different ways all the time. And unless you want to say, I don't like this entire system at all, I want to move to a Murray Rothbard system of roving gangs that enforce, you know, nominal private property through a choose your own judge adventure, which sounds definitely not corrupt at all. Then what the hell are you talking about, right? We know what that looks like. It's terrible. He gets to the point where he says, yeah, people should be able to sell children. I respect his intellectual consistency, but he's an absolute lunatic, in my opinion. Unless you're that person, then you're Milton Friedman and you're saying, yeah, we do need a state, we do need property rights, we do need a police force, we do need, you know, private property enforcement and contracts. And in that world, you've got a dollar. You've got a thing that gets issued. So there is no such thing as a privately issued dollar.
Do you think having this collateral schedule and having these banks basically pledge their assets at the Fed, does it give the public more influence or less influence over, like, banking regulations and, like,
yeah,
does it make them more or less responsive to the public?
I mean, I don't know about you. I used to be an elementary school teacher. I find this stuff convoluted as hell, and I'm a professional working in it all day, right? Secondary markets, securitization, rehypothecation, like reading the first time, finding out that you can sort of take a single treasury security and have, like, multiple actors in a day use it as their own collateral, like, on an ongoing basis, blew my mind. Like, what? This asset is in 15 places at once? On 15 people's balance sheet, and the assumption is that everyone's going to unwind it perfectly, and God forbid if they don't. Like, what? This is what the public is supposed to understand? What I'm saying is, you make a loan, you make money. It gets given to the person you make the loan for. And then we look at the loan and we see whether we like it. I can explain that to a 5-year-old. All right? You have an IOU. You give the IOU to the bank. The bank gives the IOU to the government. The government gives the bank money. The person gets the money. If the IOU is good, everything's fine. If the IOU is bad, the bank goes under. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Even trying to explain, like if we go to something more basic, like the sweep accounts that we were talking about, it's like, okay, so where to start? Let's start with the FDIC. First of all, the FDIC used to insure $100,000. That limit got changed after the Great Financial Crisis. It got moved up to $250,000. Why? I don't know. It just did. Okay.
Felt like the right number.
You know, don't worry about it. It was $100,000, and then we changed it. When did we change it? Well, there was a crisis in the 90s. You know, blah blah blah. What?
didn't want to waste the good crisis, so we didn't.
Yeah.
We moved it up.
Right. We moved it up. Just,
right.
Move up.
And we moved it up to 250, but then also, oh, by the way, like, that's just for an individual account. You can spin up multiple accounts at multiple banks and then you're covered. Oh, and also, if you don't want to do that, like, the idea of opening 40, 50, 60 accounts sounds horrific to you, don't worry. We have a specific set of rules for the banks where they can do it for you. what the fuck are we talking about right now? What the fuck are we talking about?
It's the can you explain this to a 5-year-old without them looking like you're the problem, right? Like, right, they'd be like, this is what the adults are handing me, you know? Like, this is what you've given us to work with. Yeah, look, I'm sorry. Well, you know, it's hard to change stuff. Is it? Have you been trying? Really? You can look me in the eye and tell me you've been trying to make it work? It's the same reason I say minted trillion-dollar coin, right? It's the same political logic, right? Oh, well, you see, what happens is you issue a bond and then the Federal Reserve buys up existing bonds to put extra reserves in the bank's account, which the bank then used to buy those bonds from the Treasury, and then the Treasury security that gets purchased can be sold on the secondary market if they need to get liquidity back later. But that's okay because the Fed will backstop it, and then the Fed will take all of its profits and remit it back to the Treasury on an ongoing basis. You're like, what? What?
I have such a headache already.
Right, right. Yeah. And who wins? Who wins? People who've got large legal departments. People who've got the ability to pay for $10,000 a month financial newsletters.
CFOs!
Yes, yes. The complexity is where the power elite begins, right? You look at the history of money going back 5,000 years, the Michael Hudsons of the world, the David Grabers of the world, and a lot of it begins with scribes. It begins with the technocratic elite around the warlord using their power over bureaucracy to formalize a bunch of social relationships into standardized systems, right? That is, to me, the starting point of all of this. The Catholic Church telling you can't read, right? That's the actual thing that we begin with.
Well, yeah. And Cass, I think your description of like trying to explain the complexity of like insured cash sweeps in this system as a whole was striking, because I was reading a story recently, and I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, but Giannis Antetokounmpo, the basketball player from Greece, when he originally came over into the NBA, he set up like by himself 40 to 50 different bank accounts and had like his first couple years contracts being deposited to each one. And eventually the coach like set him up with a wealth manager who was then able to explain that you can get like a single bank account that'll sweep and do this same thing.
Nice.
Because he had the cultural experience of the Greece
bank
bail-ins earlier, he had this understanding, at least at some level, that deposit insurance does have a cap and you can avoid it by distributing it. But his coach was talking about how it ended up becoming like a compliance nightmare, because every like month they had to switch over and send his payment for that month to a different account, and he had 50 different bank accounts he was managing and stuff like that, all because it is possible to get this effectively unlimited insurance if you're willing to jump through this set of prescribed hoops. But there are these hoops and steps that make it more complicated.
And the risk, just to bear in mind here, the risk that he's accounting for is something that happens so rarely.
Right.
We're talking about once every decade or two.
Right.
Like, the risk is below 1% that this is going to happen on any given day, right? And yet, you have to, this is something you genuinely should consider, because here we are. This is the third time that I've been alive that this is happening. And it's just like, God, this is insane. Like, this is not operable the way that we're doing it.
And
right
we
now.
Do bail out half of these guys, or we put them in receivership and sell the deposits. So even if you are holding uninsured deposits, the chances that you will actually lose are relatively slim. You know, there have been a lot of bank failures over the last couple of decades. The number in which uninsured depositors have lost serious amounts of money is very, very small, close to nil, right? So we are not actually even keeping this discipline serving the disciplinary function. If the whole point of this is that uninsured depositors are supposed to be a layer of oversight on bank behavior, I mean, are we really offshoring bank supervision to the Silicon Valley tech bros? Like, that's the way that we're trying to keep discipline on the banking system, is to hand it over to those people? Like, what we saw with the Silicon Valley Bank as well, as far as I understand, is that the bank was offering products to the CEOs and the founders of these companies to keep their money there, right? You get a private wealth manager, you get a personal mortgage loan, you get a personal checking account with nice perks. And we'll give you favorable loans to your entity as long as you keep your deposits with us, so that we can limit our liquidity outflow from any loans that we make. Well, again, like, what? Yes, of course, you put a bunch of Silicon Valley guys in a room with a bunch of bankers and they'll work out some creative way to make themselves both rich at everyone else's expense. Why are we trusting them? Why are we assuming this is the best way to design a banking system? Oh, that's how we've always done it. Okay.
I love that they built into their banking structure this like brinksmanship, where like in order for these startups to get these loans extended to them from Silicon Valley Bank, they had to keep their deposits there. And then all these people, when the bank run started, had to decide in their very disciplined positions whether they wanted to pay back their entire credit line and try to remove their deposits, or hope that like if they could keep their deposits there, keep their credit line open and continue functioning. They were like both of these entities, the bank and the The attempted alignment eventually reached a point where when it potentially broke, when they broke from alignment, it caused these like cascading effects for all these depositors at Silicon Valley Bank.
It's a pox on all their houses, frankly. And, you know, the fact that the regulators set it up this way, I want them to bear some of the pain here. People saying, oh, we want to make sure that it's the Silicon Valley investors that pay the cost of this. We want to make sure the bank shareholders. Yes, but also, if the regulators don't get embarrassed by this, they won't change anything, right? It's actually that moral hazard you're describing earlier. The fact that the regulators let that happen, the fact that they set this up this way, is egg on their faces, is going to put pressure on it to be changed. They can't walk into rooms and say, we're doing our job anymore. They didn't. Letting it fail in some orderly process is getting them off the hook. They can say, well, it worked. The system worked, right? The bank goes under. That's what's supposed to happen. You screwed up. You should never be allowed to let this system operate this way again. And to Cass's point, you know, am I confident the Biden administration is going to do anything about it? No, but, you know, politics is fucked right now. Doesn't mean that we don't keep our eye on the good policy. It's just nothing good is happening right now. We should have had stablecoin regulation a year and a half ago. I don't know when we're going to see that either, but it doesn't make me change what I'm advocating for. You know, there's still the good thing that we need to keep our eye on and the place that we're working towards, which is a simplified, safer, more boring banking system where you don't have pockets of complexity that people can ram a grift through.
So I'm just going to go through, unless Bennett, if you have more questions, feel free. But I'm just going to run through some questions that were dropped on a tweet that I put out suggesting that we are speaking with you, Rohan. So one is, what are the moral hazards involved in the unlimited depositor insurance? We've gone over this, so I don't think we need to address that. I'd like to know what banks would be using as collateral. I also think we've addressed that.
All of it. Suggested this. All of their loans, yeah, right? Expand the collateral schedule to everything a bank is licensed to issue. Get a price on it. Oh, and I wanted to say, to your point earlier about, is anything happening in this direction? Maybe not in the US, but actually for the last half decade in the UK, they have been moving towards what they call pre-positioning accounts, pre-positioning collateral. So that is actually something that Mervyn King advocated for in his book, The End of Alchemy, I think it's called. But basically, he described it as like a pawn shop, not a P-O-R-N, but a P-A-W-N. I have to be careful in America with my accent. A pawn shop where you can go in and pledge any collateral and there is a price. The pre-positioning is you go and get that price assessed before the crisis. So you go and you say, here's a chunk of my balance sheet. If I were to pledge this, what would you give it for me? And then the Bank of England does an assessment and says, we'd give you this haircut. And then that becomes the legally significant price. That's the liquidity price that you know you can get. I would say make it 100% and then deal with what assets you're allowed to create in the first place rather than creating tiers of it, because that still creates more additional bank failure risk. But it's the same logic, right? We already actually have a working prototype in the world of ex-ante asset side regulatory discipline in these pre-positioning accounts. So, you know, it sounds crazy, but then you say, well, what if we just took what the UK is doing and imported it here with a few tweaks? Now it starts to sound a little more doable. Now it actually starts to sound a little bit closer to viability or a little bit closer to the reality that we live in. It's not some pie-in-the-sky thing that's five steps down the chain. It's actually already happening somewhere. We just need to catch up.
How many times can they do bail-ins, bailouts before they can't anymore? Doesn't seem sustainable without causing this person says hyperinflation. I think they mean generally just issues. We had a friend of ours say unlimited times, which I said is correct, but also definitely not correct, right? Yeah. I mean, they can't, if this keeps happening, they cannot just keep solving it with the same.
Yeah, look, there's never time to do it right. There's always time to do it again, right? The beatings will continue until morale improves, right? but I think to their point, I don't think it's hyperinflation that gets caused. I think it's just an increasingly large chunk of overall investment and spending and the monetary infrastructure remains privatized in a pro-cyclical, pro-crisis regime. So one of the things that I'm interested in when I think about public investment and public spending versus bank credit and stuff is we're talking about the Green New Deal, right? We're talking about all the things that we need to decarbonize the economy. Well, you want to build a school, you want to build a casino. They both cost bricks. They both cost mortar, right? They both cost laborers. The ability to get a loan to make the casino is competing directly with the real resources that the school wants in that particular town, right? So bank credit as a source of demand is in competition with public investment as a source of demand. Not necessarily all the time. Sometimes the investments that you do with bank credit can actually generate productive capacity, etc. I'm not saying ex post, it's always that way, but ex ante, when you're making a choice between saying, okay, tomorrow there's going to be $1 billion new spending happening, either that's because we invested with public funds or because we let a bank make a loan, right? Both of those are putting claims on real resources. So the big cost of letting this happen over and over and over is not that we're going to run out of money, or it's not that the economy is going to collapse. It's that we're going to continue to let these people dictate a significantly large share of economic activity on the basis that we need them when we don't, on the basis that they're smart when they're not, and on the basis that it's the most efficient system when it isn't.
And I think just driving that full circle, yes, people lose faith in that system when that continues to happen repeatedly.
Yeah, politically, it may be unsustainable. But economically, it's sustainable in a shitty way, right? But yes, hopefully the politics become untenable. And I think that's what we're trying to do here. People want to turn down the volume on the political implications here. Well, what if we just let Silicon Valley guys lose? What if we just let the shareholders of the bank lose? Or what if it's just this localized problem? What if it's one-off to do with the specific dumb decisions that specific actors made? No, it's macro-structural. It's always been macro-structural. It is a big systemic failure in how we've designed the banking system. And until we fix that, something like this is going to keep happening, right? All there's these images saying Silicon Valley Bank's capital, you know, versus its held-to-maturity assets. It's sort of an outlier. Okay. But there's going to be a different kind of outlier tomorrow. And until we actually fix the underlying thing, which is we've created a two-tier deposit system, we've privatized the notion of insurance, et cetera, there will be another thing tomorrow. There will be another, right. I can't believe this is happening, who could have predicted?
The last question that I got, and I might be the one to address this just because I think it's a kind of a silly question, but I want to bring it up anyway. I guess they're saying the FDIC, the Federal Reserve, and the Treasury get the authority to cover more deposits than specified by law. They've always had that authority, is just what I want to say to this individual. They have always had it. As long as they've existed, when there are times of crises, they do whatever they want, essentially. So I don't know. It might not feel right. It might not feel okay. But I would suggest that when there are bank runs and there's collapses occurring left and right, they kind of have always just done whatever they want.
I feel like the answer to that is kind of like the $1 trillion coin. There's lots of laws with lots of different authorities, and one might place certain limits, but often there's another one, if you read it carefully and use your intellect, you can come up with a way to achieve your ends.
Yeah, there's a great historian of the common law, a guy named Milsom, who has this quote that I always teach where he sort of says, if the rules of property don't give you the answer you want, try the rules of contract, right? If the rules of contract don't give you the answer you want, try the rules of tort. If one tort doesn't give you the answer, try the other one, right? This is how the common law works. You're always just finding a different fiction to hang your hat on. I think the other thing about the authority here is first of all, a little shout out to my old professor, Katerina Pistor, who's got an article back from 2013 called The Legal Theory of Finance, which she says one of the things about the financial system is there is this paradox at its heart, which is we design contracts, financial contracts, under the assumption that they're going to be enforced. All right, that's how we write them. That's how lawyers draft them. That's how we think of them. When we write this money will be delivered on this day, we're assuming it's going to happen. But actually, in moments of crises, there are unforeseen events that require us to go back and renegotiate those contracts, right? We ex post adjust them. But if we knew that they weren't going to be enforced the way that they're written, then we wouldn't hold them as valuable when we're writing them. So we have to keep this contradiction in our heads that we're writing them thinking that it's actually going to happen, with the knowledge that in a crisis, it could all be completely renegotiated from scratch. And that paradox is sort of where finance lives. This sort of, we have to get up every day thinking it's all going to be the way it is because the rules say, with the knowledge that when it actually matters, the rules are going to get thrown to the side. And I think that's where, you know, the question of kind of where the authority comes in. Well, the authority comes that we have to save the system first, right? That's always the first authority, whether that's written down anywhere or not. In this case, one of the interesting things, and this is something that, you know, Fed lawyers are going to chew on for a while, is that the 13.3 authority that they used in 2008 that was extremely broad, and they defined it extremely broadly, even within an extremely broad definition, got narrowed quite a lot with Dodd-Frank. And the assumption was that narrowing would make it a lot harder to be used unless it was a really super-duper, you know, systemic event. Well, they used 13.3 this time. They didn't use the discount window. They used the emergency facilities. And the justification for that was that this was a systemic risk, right? Two banks failing was a systemic risk. Well, maybe you can make the case that the systemic risk was the high quality liquid asset regulatory classification, that a lot of banks have that. So that's something that has contagion effects. Maybe the risk is just uninsured deposits are now a subject of attention and there's a lot of them in the banking system. Whatever the systemic risk is, it was a legal stretch, but it's happened now. You don't unring that bell. You don't put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
It is funny that you bring up Dodd-Frank, because Barney Frank has become embroiled in all of this nonsense.
Mr. Tough on
Barney
Wall
Frank,
Street.
Who was responsible. Exactly. Mr. Tough on Wall Street, the man associated with Dodd-Frank, the Frank and Dodd-Frank, was a board member on Signature and made a pretty intense claim suggesting that the reason that Signature was shut down was because of its involvement with cryptocurrency and had nothing to do with its balance sheet or the crisis in depositors. Any statement about that before we call it a day?
I also just want to add, he made that statement, walked it back later in that same conversation to say we don't actually know. And then the next day, the regulator came out and said, what? No, that's not why we did this.
Yeah.
Look, Bonnie Frank is an expert at spinning Bonnie Frank, right? Like, the fact that people left the Dodd-Frank conversations thinking that this man was sort of really tough on Wall Street was kind of hilarious, right? And then the fact that he's now working on a board of a financial institution should show you where his commitments really lied. So I don't trust that man and what he says very much at all. And I certainly don't trust someone who's talking the book of the company they represent to be honest about that. But again, do we think that the 2,000-page Dodd-Frank Act was the solution? Does everyone feel safer now? You feel like the banking system has been fixed? I mean, if this guy had a...
Nothing changed.
Yeah, if this guy had a shot to shoot and he shot it, and now he gets to be a bank executive. Congratulations, you know? I hope you're happy, Barney. But, like, the rest of us are still dealing with the real problem, and, you know...
He is making millions of dollars, so I think he is happy, as a matter of
fact. He looked pretty rough when I saw him in the pictures. But, yeah, you know, but this goes to that question, right? You can take... There are people who are going to say, well, we got to get something down. We got to do something. We got to get a win. I work with those people all the time. They're always the people advocating some shitty half-ass measure. My view is it's always better to get something down now, and then, one day we'll get it fixed. Will we? Where are you for that part of the conversation? It's weird how you always say that in one room, and then I go to that other room called the one day we'll get it fixed room, and you're never there. You're in a bank CEO suite, you know? What the fuck? So, yeah, I don't have much love for Bonnie Frank, and I don't think that the fact that, you know, Bonnie Frank, of all people, said this. A bank executive blamed the Fed for its problems. News at 11, you know?
I will also add, just right before we close this out on the topic of Signature, that Bloomberg reported today that Signature was under a Department of Justice criminal probe. Just for that added bit of context around their closure, so all of our audience is on the same page about Bernie Frank's comments.
Good.
There you go. All right. Well, so thank you for joining us for the third time, Rohan. It was wonderful to have you on to discuss this. I'm sorry it couldn't be more of a debate. You guys already won. And here we are.
Yeah, God damn it, Cass. Learn your lesson next time. Don't try to argue with Bennett and I. Thank you very much for having me. It was an absolute pleasure. See you on the other side.